Hello and welcome to another edition of the Confession Box podcast. My name is Brandon Scott. I'm joined by Wendy Grace, who is a broadcaster on Spirit Radio. Wendy, we're delighted today to be joined by Dr. Francis Rees, who is a legal expert at Essex Law School in England. Dr. Francis, how are you finding Ireland? How are you doing in your short period here?
Oh, I'm having a great time. It's lovely to be home.
Oh, home? Sorry, I didn't even know that. This is where research is so important here.
Yes, exactly.
It's the surname Rees. It's quite a British sounding.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that'll be the English husband.
Yeah. So in your particular, you particular focus on the nature of child influencers, and it's a very intricate area, I suspect, because there's not a lot of information surrounding child influencers. We're only getting to the grips of it now. So can you tell us more about you've conducted a survey in relation to child influencers, I suppose, and the impacts and potential implications that being a child influencer may have on both parent and child. So tell us more about that survey and maybe some of the findings or potential findings that you might establish.
Lovely, thank you. Yes, the desk-based research has been done at the moment. So my research focused on looking at the child, even if you don't recognise the kind of moniker of influencer, but thinking about the child as performer. So the child on the other side of the lens, really, as opposed to a lot of the focus that tends to be on screen time or content that kids are watching themselves and how kids are interacting with their phones or social media. So the research looks at the child that's performing the content, so the child that's on the other side that hopefully a child is looking at, but unfortunately might not necessarily be a child looking at the child performer. So the research breaks down critical harms or issues that I've identified. And some of that's as simple as looking at the context of how a child performer would behave in other industries, like on a film set or a photo shoot. You can imagine that Daniel Radcliffe and all of the kids on Harry Potter had school provisions, so they had proper education when they were on set.
And people looking after their well-being.
Absolutely. Any stunts that they did would have been risk assessed, any equipment that they used, all of that. And any adults that they interacted would have been DBS checked or, you know, gone through the right processes. So if you think about a child on a photo shoot or a film set, there's a whole layer of protections there that they would have that they don't have when they're on social media. Simple things like insurance even, because if you're acting as an influencer within your home, home insurance wouldn't cover any harms because you're kind of running a business. So it's things like that that people don't really think about. And the research breaks this down into six critical areas. So the standard areas would be the things that people would think about, like the money. Where does the money go? So is the child potentially losing earnings that they would have protected for them if they were a model or an actor?
Because the contract's between the parent and the brand, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the brand are giving the parent the money for the performance aspect, or it sometimes even boils down to a pair of trainers or a trip to a nice restaurant or something like that. So in return, the brand would get this content, and it could be a reel or could be an image or some sort of performance from the child. So the money's kind of one aspect. The other would be the education. So I mentioned the kind of provision of education on set. But usually a local authority would be informed, and the local authority would then know what the impact on the child's education might be. For example, if they had to take time out of school for this, or if there's impact on their homework or things like that. So
what about just their understanding of what they're participating in? You know, because when you think of, maybe people will think of, what's the last video that you saw online that was of a child? Maybe it was something funny. Maybe it was something that was useful to you. I'm thinking of a video where it was, you know, a parenting expert showing their child, here's how they were before my method, tantrum after tantrum after tantrum. But that child probably didn't consent to being filmed in that way.
Yep. So that's one of the angles we look at, is the potential invasion of their privacy. So some of the articles written in this area talk about compensating for the privacy, but then other aspects, like in France, where they've regulated this area, they talk about the child's right to be forgotten. So can the child ask for the content to be removed? But that obviously stands upon the premise that a child would understand that the content is there, for starters, and that they have a problem with it, and that they could have a conversation with a parent to have it removed. So if you're talking about content of 2, 3, 4 year olds, that's quite a complex, like the right to be forgotten or the right to erasure is really complicated, complex notion to try and get across to a child
and,
in that way.
And Dr. Francis, can I just return? You're talking about money and potential assets there. I'm just fascinated. Like, is it an ultra competitive market where I suppose it takes a lot of time and persistence to succeed? Or is it that any old person picks up a phone and they're immediately successful and it's a very lucrative prospect for them? Or what's the story around that?
No, it's like any family business, it takes time to build, unless you do something quite unusual or the child hits a certain moment, you know, the viral sensations. It can be a matter of accumulating followers and likes and shares and clicks and those sorts of things, which leads to quite artificial conversations sometimes within families around that external view of the child in terms of popularity, in terms of numbers, in terms of brands expecting you to have certain types of numbers and followers before you can gain the monetization. So the early stages, it might just be products that you'll get free. But your ultimate goal is, I guess, if you wanted to make a career out of this, to be building your followers. So
but it's competitive in terms of you need clicks, you have to create clickbait. So it's about, how do I create content that, whether it's cute or funny or shock factor or whatever it is, like that's what people click on.
Yeah.
So what role does the child have in that in terms of even just that thing of maybe some being kind of catapulted into being a performer without even realizing it?
Yeah, and that's some of the stuff that comes up in one of the harm clusters that I look at in relation to the dignity of the child. So thinking about those viral moments that might have come because of a trick being played on the child or something untrue being told to the child, like their Xbox has been broken or, that you're looking at those moments that we would understand to be performative, but the child might not perceive as performative and might be really upset by. So thinking about like, what is it that we're doing? The child would not be able to distinguish what's acting and what's real because we're looking for those real emotions from them to generate the attention that it would take for people to engage with it through social media.
And who are the main drivers, I suppose, of this? Because, you know, is it the parent or is it voluntarily? Is it the child, you know, voluntarily saying, well, I want to produce content, I think I'm very interesting or something like that? Because I have come across a lot of parents and the ethics around it are quite questionable, where they might be branding a speech impediment or they might be branding a disability. There's a commercial aspect to it. Oh, look how endearing this person is. You know, you're going to enjoy this. And some accounts I have come across, actually, there are people with Down syndrome or people with learning difficulties. And look, for the most part, it's very, you know, it's very redeeming and it's very tasteful and whatnot. But the ethics around that are quite questionable. Do you find that a lot of parents are pressurizing the child into a certain situation like this or a setting, or, you know, is there a mutual consent there between the two?
Sure, it's hard in my situation. I guess I was talking to Wendy earlier. I feel sometimes like I'm the person writing the directions for the back of the bottle of bleach. You know, that I have to hear the horror stories. So have I got examples of parents who've coerced and abused their children in order to get content from them? Yes, I do. Unfortunately, those stories are out there. What I would say is they are the extremes. I don't know, you know, I know Wendy, you're a parent and you understand how difficult it can be to get a child to go anywhere and look, wear the right thing, say the right thing, be where you want to be at the right time and have everything with you. So if you can imagine like going through life with a child where you need them to kind of behave a certain way or look a certain way or pose for a family picture and look nice for 5 minutes. That's hard enough. But if you're now exacerbating that into, well, the child's got to wear this specific thing, say
and
this
did
specific
so well, we
thing,
got sent this product or that. Or,
yeah,
you know,
say it to a camera, to a deadline, make sure they get the brand name right. All of this stuff that obviously, like some of these things that look like they take 30 seconds, it's been proven that they can take 3 days of a child's life.
It's a conditioning almost,
to get that content.
And do the brand, the brands obviously know that, you know, a peer speaks to peer, you know, especially particular age of children. They're going to be influenced by people that are close to their age or people they aspire to be, that has a powerful impact. So they want kids speaking to kids about their products.
Yeah, absolutely. The kids are 3 times more likely to purchase something because they see a peer online wearing. So they're very influenced by this influencer culture themselves. It's replaced those, you know, role models that we had in traditional media growing up. They're now more heavily influenced, but it's transient. It's got a shelf life, you know, it's quick moving. It's much quicker, more rapid than the people of posters we would have had up on our wall when we were growing up. So when I talk about a family business, I sometimes think about, like, if I had a farm, maybe the child would be helping out with whatever needed doing. Or if I had a restaurant, the child might be wiping the tables. But hopefully, luckily, all things being well, the restaurant and the farm would still be there when the child was old enough to take over. Whereas this has such a short shelf life that the child's not going to be cute anymore. And if the money hasn't been minded, or if there was no real money, there was just stuff.
Is there as well a bit of naivety around just how different videos or images can be interpreted? You know, if I show my mum a picture of my little girl in her ballet class and her little pigtails and her little leotard and all that sort of stuff, that's beautiful to her. But, you know, if I put that image up online for the world to see, different people will see that image in different ways, and acknowledging that, are we joining the dots with that type of kind of behaviour?
Absolutely. So, yeah, again, in terms of dignity, that's one of the things that the project looks at in relation to the hypersexualization of some of this media and content that we would think is cute. Or if we've got a young gymnast in the family, or we're on a family holiday at the beach, we might have photos of kids in swimwear or kids in leotards. And it's like asking that question as to, is this something we'd feel comfortable with on a billboard at the shops?
And advertisers wouldn't get away with it. As in, if I'm an influencer and I put up a bit, here's us in Spain and we're on our swimming togs, it's all, but you wouldn't see that on a bus stop.
And that's how I think about it as well, in terms of brands are, you know, giving young gymnasts leotards, and then young gymnasts are posing in leotards in the positions they need to hold for gymnastics. But it's not, unfortunately, always other 8-year-old gymnasts who are looking at those pictures. And the New York Times did a piece recently on this area where they looked at comments for pictures like that, and they screenshotted some of the comments were pretty unpleasant, and they were from adult males rather than other gymnasts.
And in an Irish context, we've had our own problems as well, I suppose, with the over-sexualization, particularly with teens. I think it emerged, I think a teacher's body said that there was a startling increase in the number of children taking very sexualized pictures, very suggestive pictures of themselves, and distributing these pictures around, maybe to their peers, or they might be acting on request, or it might be all voluntarily. It might be voluntarily done. I don't know. But do you think that it's because of the kind of the prevailing culture in social media now, where they might be looking to an influencer that they aspire to be, and they're posing in a specific way, or they're wearing certain clothes, or their mannerisms, even it could be something as basic as their mannerisms, and they're attempting to imitate that, because the teachers have said in the analogy, or the kind of example that they used of how sensitive this issue is that it's the confirmation year, that's the age that the highest incidence is coming from, the confirmation year. So do you think that it might be, is a bit speculative to say that it might be because of, you know, the kind of the social media trends and the influences that they might be aspiring to behave like and look like?
Potentially, yes. I mean, it is that situation. Unfortunately, women in media historically have always had to become more sexualized in order to gain that attention and to secure that. And it takes a strong woman, a strong, you know, female that goes against that trend usually. But, you know, the kids have had the whole world in their hands for a number of years now, and have grown up have seen more mature content very young as a result. They're able to access things that we would never have been able to access when we were growing up. So that has led to a normalization and almost a pornification of content that they feel they can share with each other, and you know, the exposure of certain types of imagery to each other has been normalized, unfortunately. And that's where, if I'm talking about the performative aspect, if kids are being asked to do that, they might question that less than they would have historically, and it might not seem as unusual to
them.
This
is it. Like when we were growing up, you know, the camera came out on holidays and certain myself and my sibling, oh dad, put that thing away, and you hated it. But now obviously we have a camera 24/7 in our pocket that our kids are so used to us taking out all the time, and everything is captured on the phone and all that sort of stuff. I mean, when I hold up my phone, even if I'm not taking a picture, my 2-year-old says, cheese, because that's what she associates.
Yeah.
And they're used to their life being on display all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I feel as well. I suppose my biggest concern is kind of the psychological implications of all of this. Like, I think there's a conditioning that's going on. When I was young, the internet was still, you know, it was still in existence, but we had dial up and it was very arduous and cumbersome to try and get it up and whatnot. But phones were pretty standard. They were basic. But now children are growing up, you know, with all of these technologies in front of them and all of these functions that they can use, you know, rapidly. And I'm just wondering, because it's creating a conditioning, as you said, because maybe families might be commodifying their child's uniqueness or whatnot, you know, are there long-term social, there have to be long-term mental impacts and psychological impacts on the child that will probably only be recognized when they're out of that formative age and into maybe a more mature age, and they're like, wow, my perception of reality was entirely warped.
Yeah, I often call it the Drew Barrymore moment. You know, that
there's a term.
I'm thinking about the future children who especially as a lawyer, I'm like thinking about the future children who are going to be in that position going, I'm not okay. And I'm not okay with what's been done to me over those years. And who do I hold to account? And obviously, the platforms wash their hands of it because they say nothing to do with us. You were under 13. Your parents decided for you. And then the brand similarly. So it unfortunately, it's not about kind of finger pointing at parents or calling out bad parenting or anything like that. It's not about judgment. It's about recognizing that, unfortunately, the parents are putting themselves in a position where they become accountable for this. And one day, somewhere down the line, the person is going to come back to them and ask them the questions, is their own child. And they have to be okay with that. And both of you have given me examples where we had to take a beat. You know, you talked about dial up and you talked about old photos. In both of those situations, we all had to take a moment and think about consciously what we were doing. And we had to go down to the Photoshop and get them printed out, and there'd be someone's thumb or whatever. And you might only get 3 decent photos out of 20.
The difference now is our parents wouldn't blow them up and hold them on Grafton Street. Isn't she so cute there? You know. Do we get that we, when we put something up online in terms of that digital footprint, you're opening up to the, like, anybody can see it, screenshot it, if it's on certain websites, download it thousands of times.
Yeah. I've been talking to parents who are either part of this industry or who have left this industry or left these practices behind, and talking about accounts that they've had previously, even blogging an imagery of their children that and they've realized that have been downloaded thousands of times, and that they now appreciate that that's given them that moment to pause. But I guess that's what the research that I'm doing is trying to do, is give us that moment to pause, in that it seems daunting to look at 32 potential issues in this area that go from everything from insurance to money to education to sexualization. But it's about kind of doing that little mini audit of yourself and your own practices and what you're sharing and what it looks like and what it could be perceived as externally, and just like that, taking a beat
and how your child might feel about it in future years. And that's the fact that that footprint is there. I mean, can you scrub? I mean, I remember going through my Facebook and different accounts and taking down any pictures of my children after kind of learning a little bit more about it and kind of reading a few kind of scary articles about how pictures could be used and manipulated and doctored and, you know, used on pornographic sites, all that sort of stuff. But I don't know, were they downloaded or screenshotted? I mean, is it possible to scrub the internet of what you put up there once it's in the ether.
Once it's there effectively. Mm. And that imagery is out there if somebody has saved it or has got a little folder somewhere of things that they are very interested in keeping hold of, that's what they will have done. You know, in terms of data, in terms of any types of sharing, it's not just the imagery, it's the information that we're sharing about the children. So, you know, if you think about even as adults now, those strange security questions that we still get, your first school and your first pet and your mother's maiden name and date of birth and all of those things, we're just freely giving out all of that information through that imagery ourselves. So aren't they lovely? Oh, we just got a puppy. Okay, great. I now know the first pet's name. Mm-hmm. And it is. It's like whether it's magnified out into commercialization or monetization or products or whatever it can grow out into, even at that initial phase of thinking about digitally, what we're sharing about our children has got impact.
And is there anybody, Dr. Rees, looking at how appropriate content is? And I even mean things like children who are 9 or 10 using face creams for adult women, okay? Mm. And they're this trend called Get Ready With Me, and you see these kind of pre-adolescent teenage girls mostly sharing their routines. I'm up at 5 o'clock in the morning. But who's the one kind of policing that? Is it still a case of those social media companies, well, the parent is, you know, the one who's responsible ultimately, and did they just wash their hands of it?
Unfortunately, again, as any parent will know, if a child's really driven to do something, you asked me the question earlier about, you know, is it what a child wants to do? Yeah. If a child really wants to do something, you see this heavily in the gaming industry. You know, you've got a lot of young gamers who potentially can give up school and make a living from gaming. And somebody I work with in the UK is looking at this specifically in terms of what impact that has on their education, because it's very easy for the parent to tick the box then to say they're being homeschooled. What does that look like and what does that mean? And it's very easy in certain situations where this is unregulated for parents to say, oh, do you know what, this school thing's becoming a bit cumbersome, let's try homeschooling. Yeah. Because there's you know, going to be definitely something professionally that could be benefited here. If somebody's going to be a professional gamer, professional influencer, professional gymnast, whatever they're going to be.
And in terms of, I suppose, regulation there, who is enforcing any guidelines, if you know, like, and first of all, are the guidelines adhered to? Are they outlined on websites? Can you see them? And what do they comprise usually in terms of what's a violation and what isn't perceived to be a violation? And also, sorry, I know there are a lot of questions here, but who usually polices that? Is there a specific body in the social media apps or the companies?
So the genesis of this project started with looking at it from a regulatory point of view, as the lawyer in me would make sure I had to.
Yeah.
The two jurisdictions, so France legislated for this in 2020. So the French legislation has been in place for a while, and Belgium are just about to roll out a similar model to the French model. So looking at the regulation for this, effectively what France have done is brought it in line with how child modelling and acting would be perceived. So the money would be placed under a trust for the child. So some of the earnings are placed securely away for the child. The local authority is told in relation to the impact on the education, and the child has the right to erasure. So the child has the right for the content to be removed. So I got to speak to Bruno Studé, who's the politician who introduced the law in France, and his ethos was that this is happening and it's about informing and making parents aware of the potential issues. So it was very interesting to hear a legislator talk about it from that point of view, not prohibitory, but kind of educational. Unfortunately, however, in looking at how it has worked, you talked about enforcement, it's practically impossible to police, because all of that power is still in the hands of the parents. The parents are the ones who have to report that the child is working effectively and to the local authority. The parents are the ones who have to declare the income and put it into the account, so that they work with the brand in doing that as well, which is some accountability there. And obviously, as we talked about earlier, the concept of the child understanding that they have the right to removal and being able to have an open, clear communication with the parent for that to happen, it is hard to enforce and understand.
And
that's
even
been met.
Standards of what the content is. So again, going back to traditional advertising or acting, you know, if there's something made by children for children, a children's film, for example, there's certain standards that we'll accept won't be portrayed in that film, whether it's language or sexualization or whatever it is. But how do you police that online when those lines of kind of acceptance of what's appropriate for a child are being crossed?
Absolutely. And I've worked closely with BBC and the ITV in the UK as well, and I'm sure the RTE are the same here, in terms of if they've got a child on set or if they're involving a child in any type of content or programming, the level of security and safety and risk assessment is very high, and their kind of guidelines and
we consider the child who's doing the performance and then the viewer as well. That's why we have certification or water tests or all those sorts of things. But so you don't have that on social media.
Any of that at all. And that's kind of where the project's headed, in terms of now looking at two jurisdictions where there's no legislation, that even in jurisdictions where there is legislation, it's not being enforced and it's still down to the parents. And here I'm now in Ireland and the UK looking at it from a point of view of, okay, so if we're still going to end up having to talk to the parents and putting the power in their hands, let's start that conversation.
Something that's come to my attention there, I think this would be perfect for the EU maybe to make an intervention there, because it's the type where we have a governing body and a harmonised approach is probably best, whereas we might have markedly different legislation and policies in different countries that might be a bit disjointed and incoherent. But has the EU come forward with any proposals of maybe a more streamlined policy for all of its member states? Because I think that would be very beneficial.
That's really interesting. So there's been some criticism of the French of going solo in this regard, exactly for that reason of like, why can't we have a more joined up approach? So, and there are aspects of it. The focus at the moment is on the Digital Services Act. So the focus really, in terms of pressure points, is about child as viewer and child as consumer.
The cynic in me would say, though, hang on, this is a multi-billion dollar industry in terms of the brands that are making money out of these child influencers. They have a lot of power in the jurisdictions we're talking about. And the cynic in me would go, really, is the child's welfare going to trump all that money?
Absolutely. The industry's booming. It's growing year on year. It's $24 billion globally at the moment. And another reason why there's no point in waggling fingers at parents. You know, parents are so far down the food chain and so, out of the loop economically in this game. And it is a game and it is an industry. And a lot of people are making money. You've got influencer agencies, you've got marketing agencies.
What are they selling mostly?
Branding. 85% of brands are using influencer marketing. They're finding it far cheaper and far more efficient to be sending items out to a lot of low-level influencers than to stage a photo shoot or a big marketing campaign. It's just financially makes more sense for them.
No, definitely it's more affordable.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
there's been a lot of, just finally to ask you, Dr. Rees, there's been a lot of discussion here in Ireland recently, but it's more on the viewer, the child as viewer rather than performer. But obviously they are connected, because without the viewer, the influencer wouldn't exist in the first place. On things like, you have, you know, primary schools trying to encourage voluntary codes of, look, delay giving a phone until second level if you can. And kind of community initiatives where people are saying, gosh, this is really hard as a parent to monitor and all that sort of stuff. And kind of cultural change happening. How much of that is part of the picture? Is it all about regulation, or what are the things that would kind of impact change in a positive way?
I think we talked formally about like culture shift. You know, we've as communities and as societies identified shifts in behaviours and things that we have to focus on and things that we have to arm ourselves about and educate, but it's taking time. Even if I love Professor Sonia Livingston in England talks about the comparison with road safety. You know, we built the roads and we made the cars, and a lot of people got rich and a lot of people were able to get to work a lot quicker, but it took a lot of joined up thinking around how safe are kids in cars, how safe are kids on roads.
I know we laugh about now car seats, there wasn't car, you know, yeah, exactly. In a certain generation, yeah. Whereas now yeah. It'd be horrifying yeah. not to put, you know, a 2-year-old in a car seat.
It took a lot, it took car designers, town planners, road authorities, parents, all sorts of people to come together as a collective and to change practices. We talked about smoking to vaping earlier as well. And you see these shifts in cultural behaviours where something, it's not just not cool anymore, it's that it's not safe anymore yeah. and the harms are recognised. So I'm hoping that this project acts as a little bit of a gateway of, like I say, take a beat, have a think.
How can people get involved, Frances?
So the project website has got two surveys. So I've got an Irish survey specifically for the Irish audience. One of the reasons, not just because I wanted to get home, but one of the reasons I chose Ireland was because Ireland actually ranks quite low in terms of digital civility towards each other online, in the online arena, and specifically 8 to 12-year-olds were feeling unsafe within that space. And 42% of parents were asking for more support as well in that space. So I'm working with Cyber Safe Kids web-wise, and I'm in conversations with ISPCC and the Data Protection Commission. So again, trying to have that like joined up conversation around what safety looks like in this area. There's a survey on the website, and if anybody would like, has views on the opinions on this, the survey does critique the issues, the potential harms that could be in this industry, and asks people to think about whether they might recognize them as harmful themselves.
And I suppose as well, what would your definitive advice be to parents? If the onus is on parents there to monitor their child's activity online, what would be your definitive advice to parents, you know, in if they are, I suppose, in a position where their children are online and they don't know what type of content they're producing or even observing?
I think it's just general parental information and conversation. Conversation at every stage of the process, like having conversations in the build-up to, this is something I might like to do. Looking at how to manage that safely, thinking about the range of harms that you could be exposing a child to within this workspace, because it does become a workspace. And then afterwards, you know, making sure there are those moments to take pause afterwards too, if the child needs mental health support because of some of the opinions or exposure that they've received, and, you know, or whether the content should be removed at a later stage.
Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Frances Weiss. Those insights were absolutely so interesting and insightful. So thank you for joining us. And we hope you continue to listen to our podcast on the Confession Box with me, Brandon Scott, and Wendy Grace. Thank you very much for listening.